This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture programming from NPR. I am Netta Ulaby, Arts Desk Reporter.
And I'm Bob Mondello, movie critic for All Things Considered.
I've got an important reminder for new listeners. You can subscribe to this podcast by going to npr.org/culturetopia. This week, we're all about the movies. We've got interviews with the actress Emily Blunt talking about her role in The Young Victoria, and Jeff Bridges describing his singing performance in Crazy Heart.
We bust some myths about how Daniel Day-Lewis prepared for his role in Nine, and then director Terry Gilliam returns with his latest movie, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. But first,
in its opening weekend, Avatar took in $73 million domestically and $232 million worldwide. So, against the predictions of skeptics, you know who you are, director James Cameron has an innovative 3D blockbuster to add to his ever-growing list of massive hit movies. Avatar is live action, but it uses a revolutionary computer-generated, or CG, technology to create a lush world of bioluminescent jungles and an indigo indigenous population, the 10-foot-tall cat-like Na'vi.
The language is a pain, but, you know, I figure it's like field stripping a weapon. Just repetition, repetition.
Na'vi.
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 Stronger.
Neytiri calls me Scown. It means moron.
NPR's Melissa Block spoke with James Cameron about the film and about how he wrenched emotional performances from his actors, even when they were stuck playing against a gray screen.
Well, my challenge as director is to make it as real for them as possible. And their challenge as an actor is to imbue it with a sense of emotional veracity. Because, you know, actors don't really rely on the set that much anyway, because even in a live action set, they look up and they mostly see some grip standing on a ladder with his you know, and a bunch of bright lights and a bunch of, you know, stands and flags and that sort of thing. So usually by the time a shot is lit, you can barely see the set from standing where the actors are. So they don't really feed much from that. What they feed from in terms of inspiring their performance moment is the other actors. And so, you know, we found it to be this very kind of pure and very focused work.
You did, though, before you started shooting, you sent the cast to Hawaii, to the rainforest. Why'd you do that?
Well, I figured if they're going to work in this austere gray space, they'd need something to feed their sense of where they were so that they could create a reality, you know. So the concept being, you know, we'll go out into the rainforest, and if it rains, whatever, and you'll be in some sort of rough version of your tribal wardrobe, and then just, you know, kind of hunker down and do a scene right there in the middle of the jungle. We surprised a few hikers.
Yeah, I bet you did.
With, you know, Sam, you know, running around in a loincloth, you know, with a bow and arrow.
This is Sam Worthington, the main character.
Sam Worthington, right, exactly.
What were some of the flaws in other CGI, computer-generated imagery films that you saw that you were trying to improve here? What do you think you were trying to do to make it better?
Honestly, I just didn't think they were doing it right. They weren't getting any information from how the eyes are moving. They weren't seeing how the tongue and the lips and the teeth were interacting with each other to form syllables and sounds. And so by uncoupling the facial capture from the body capture, which is what we did on Avatar, and using this head rig or this image-based system, we really got every bit of detail that was needed to reproduce the actor's performance later in the CG character. And I mean down to every tiny amount of tension around the mouth or around the eyes, every blink, every tiny dart, and that all translated exactly to the final characters, which gave a real sense of truth and life to these characters.
I think that's absolutely fair. I think he absolutely accomplished that, and it's driving me crazy. I you know, next week on All Things Considered, I'm going to be talking about the fact of having to try it for a critic. This doesn't matter for an audience, but for a critic, trying to figure out what the actor is doing and how much of it is influenced by the fact that the skin is blue, that the tail is wagging, that the eyes are three times the size that they would normally be in the face, and the way that you're reacting to all of that, which is very different. And it's really tricky. It's a very interesting picture. He's done it is spectacular to look at. I mean, just spectacular. It's gorgeous. But It's going to take me a while to sort it all out.
Well, up next, we've got a performance by an actress who had to go through time rather than space. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's the movie The Young Victoria. And as we see her at the beginning, this is way before she's become a queen. She's a beautiful teenager, sheltered from the world, not at all prepared for power. The queen is played by Emily Blunt. And as she told Linda Wertheimer, this young Victoria is definitely not the dumpy black-clad matron we've seen in all those photographs.
You know, I think that's the Victoria that people know about, the old grizzled, witchy-looking woman who's wheeled around looking sour. And that sort of presents to you that image of Victoriana, which was the repression that seemed to kind of sweep across the country. But that really came as a result of Albert dying at such a young age. And I think it literally transformed her, because before that she was this vibrant girl. And I think what the film does is actually present to you exactly why she mourned him so ferociously and why everyone has this image of her in the later years. But it certainly wasn't the case when she was young.
How do you know that?
Because I read everything I could on her, and I read her diaries and letters, and there were anecdotes from people at court who would say that she would laugh at dinner so hard that food would just fall out of her mouth. I mean, she used to dance all night till 3 a.m. I mean, she was a party girl. She was rebellious.
Now, before her 18th birthday, the way it's portrayed in a movie, she was sort of a prisoner of her background. She was next in line to the throne. But she did not go to court. She had very little access to the court, didn't seem to have many friends.
I think it was incredibly lonely. I think she wasn't allowed any privacy. She wasn't allowed to play. She slept in the same room as her mother till she was 18. I think her mother and the mother's advisor, Sir John Conroy, wanted it this way so that they could control her when she became queen, giving them more power. But she was one of these very resilient girls, and I don't really understand how she was able to be that strong in wanting what was rightly hers, which was to rule independent of anyone who had been trying to handle or control her for all those years.
The other thing, of course, that is so extraordinary that we know but we don't really know about Victoria is her romance, which essentially was a political calculation, I believe, an effort by her uncle, the King of Belgium, to increase his power over her and his influence in England. She compares herself at one point to a chess piece.
I see them leaning in and moving me around the board. Uncle Leopold, the king, show off the politicians are ready to seize hold of my skirts and drag me from square to square.
Then you had better master the rules of the game until you play it better than they can.
You don't recommend I find a husband to play it for me?
I should find one to play it with you, not for you.
Yeah, I think that she was being used as a pawn, but so was Albert. And so I think as soon as they both realized they were being gamed, the guards went down and they actually found a very genuine, real love. I mean, they really were soulmates. They were sort of twin flames that were essentially perfect together, and he was by far her greatest achievement. So for an arranged marriage to become such a passionate love affair was so rare, and I think she definitely didn't imagine it to go that way.
You know what is hysterical? I saw this picture and had no idea how it was going to come out. I'm serious. I watched it, and when Albert showed up, I mean, I don't know anything about Queen Victoria. I 100 years ago, I went to school and learned a little bit. And I went to this picture, and I'm watching it, and there's all these machinations with the prime minister trying to influence how things go. And I thought, well, he's handsome. Maybe he ends up, you know, influencing her somehow. And as it went on, she meets this guy named Albert, and I thought, oh, there's a Victoria and Albert museum. They must have gotten together. It's literally the level at which I'm watching this thing. And so I know for a lot of audiences who are going to see it, this is history, right? And what they're watching is a history lesson. For me, it was actually sort of a neat narrative that I was puzzled as to how it was going to come out.
And it was one of how many movies that you've seen this month?
Oh, God, so many. I think it was 25 movies I've seen, and it's not quite 25 days yet in this month. This is the time of year when critics get all Kabbalic stuff. My biggest day, actually, was on one day I saw in the morning at one theater, we saw Sherlock Holmes. 15 minutes later, we had to be at a different theater across town to see The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Both of those pictures have Jude Law in them. Both of those pictures have early shots with St. Paul's Cathedral in it. Both of those pictures feel kind of 19th century. I was like, and then after that, I went to see Nine in the evening. And that's a third brand of fantasy, right? I mean, it's, you know, this big elaborate musical. And I was just sort of wigged at the end of that. And, you know, ask me which scene is from which movie immediately after. If I hadn't been taking notes, I would have no idea. It was just craziness.
And this is because all of the Oscar bait is getting thrown into the
yeah, seat. They pretty much, they have to show it to everybody before the critics groups make their nominations for Best Actor and all that kind of thing. So they want to show it early in the month, even though the pictures aren't necessarily opening until later, and they would usually show the pictures later. So you get this sudden crush when all the film companies realize at the same moment that they have to show these things. And the days just get really crazy. I had 12 films in 1 week. That's craziness. I mean, you know, how do you keep them all straight?
And we think your job is just kicking back and eating popcorn.
Well, it is. Most of the time, it's a great gig, but every once in a while, it gets a little complicated.
Well, one of the films that was on the docket for you is going to stick out for a variety of reasons, and that's The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. That one follows a small acting troupe traveling through London, performing from a dilapidated portable stage. Its best prop is the Imaginarium. That's a magical mirror that can transport anyone from the audience into an imaginary world. Heath Ledger played the part of Tony Shepherd, who joins the troupe and offers some marketing strategies.
You know, forgive me, but I have a couple of solutions to your problems. One, I was thinking of, you know, changing the style of the show. And two, I would change the audience, perhaps.
Change?
Yeah. You know, but in my opinion, I'd change both. But, you know, that's just me.
That was Heath Ledger's last film. 3 days after the first round of filming wrapped, Heath Ledger died. So the director, Terry Gilliam, who's faced horrible obstacles on his movie sets before, came up with a really creative solution. He brought in three A-list actors, Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell, who all stepped in to play little bits of Ledger's role that were incomplete at the time of his death. Gilliam spoke to NPR's Guy Raz about how this actually made the movie stronger.
I don't think in the entire history of motion pictures anything like this has actually happened, where the lead actor dies literally in the middle of production, and we managed to get three A-list actors to come in and continue his part.
That's director Terry Gilliam, and as he mentioned, three A-list actors, Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell, all stepped in to play little bits of Heath Ledger's role that were incomplete at the time of his death, the parts that took place inside the mirror, the Imaginarium. And to make it work, Terry Gilliam came up with a rather ingenious solution.
We had already established in the script the principle that if you go through the mirror with somebody else, their imagination may be stronger than yours, and you become what they want you to be. And with a bit of fiddling, a few bits of dialogue, I just made that clearer. And so the initial one is this lady who looks, and it's Johnny, and she says, "Ah, I always dreamed you would look like this." And it works. And once the audience accepted that first change, it just flowed after that. It was great.
How did those actors agree to do this? Did they reach out to you after Heath Ledger's death?
No, I mean, the first one was Johnny, because Johnny was a very close friend, and he was a close friend of Heath's as well, and I called him a day or two after Heath died, and just commiserating. And I said, "I don't know what I'm going to do. I might just close it down. I really don't know." And he says, "Well, whatever you decide to do, I'm there." And then I started calling other actors who were close friends of Heath's, because I wanted to keep this in the family. And Colin and Jude, it was possible that we could shift our schedules and they could shift theirs a bit, and they could be in the film. And so that's what happened. It actually was an incredible dance between our schedule and their three schedules. And in fact, in the end, Johnny was finally available because Michael Mann's film Public Enemy had, at the very last moment, been delayed 1 week, and we got Johnny.
For a day and a half, I read.
Day and 3.5 hours.
How close did that tragedy come to derailing this entire project?
When Heath died, I mean, the first reaction was I was just pulling the plug on the whole thing. I mean, personally devastated. I surround myself with people who don't listen to me. And one of them was my daughter, who was one of the producers, and she just kept kicking me until I got up off the floor and said, okay, we'll find a solution to this thing. What was interesting about it was that almost everything that I had to do to salvage the film improved the film. That's what was strange about it. One scene I couldn't do, and we don't need it. Another scene I shifted from this side of the mirror to the Imaginarium side of the mirror, and it works better. I said that in some ways Heath was co-directing this film posthumously because he didn't let me do certain things that I'd originally planned to do, and all of them were for the better.
You could hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
What's your real name?
I'm Bab Blake. Wasn't born bad. When I die, my tombstone will have my real name on it. Until then, I'm just going to stay bad.
Jeff Bridges is the Bad Blake in the new film Crazy Heart. His character is a washed-up alcoholic country singer, reduced to playing in bowling alleys and dive bars, driving himself to gigs in a battered old Chevy Suburban. NPR's Melissa Block spoke with Jeff Bridges about how he prepared for his role as a singer.
All my life I've been a rolling stone, done everything that a man can do, everything to get a hold on. That a man can do.
What do you hear here in your performance?
I hear how much fun I had, for one thing. I hear T-Bone telling me, we're going to make you sound good, Jeff. We're going to, you know, have songs that are going to be in your wheelhouse. We're not going to call upon you to do something that you're not going to be able to do. And we're going to tailor make the songs to fit you and Bad.
You mentioned T-Bone. T-Bone is T-Bone Burnett, the music producer, one of the producers of the film. T-Bone Burnett says, of watching you in this movie, he thinks you look like Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, which is really striking as you're watching it. You have that look, that grizzled, bearded, I'm in this and I'm kind of a country outlaw kind of look.
Yeah, one of the first directions that Scott Cooper gave me was that if Bad was alive and it was a real character, that he would be the fifth highwayman. Do you know who the highwaymen
are?
Yeah,
absolutely. Willie.
Yeah, Willie, Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, and Kris. So I took that to heart, and I'm a friend of Kris's, and Kris actually, we screened the movie, and Kris was there. We were laughing together how much, you know, we looked alike, and looked at each other in the mirror, put our heads together and looked in the mirror and had a good laugh.
You and Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to say that in this movie, Colin Farrell shows up again, who was also in Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and in this one, he's a country singer. And, I mean, in Imaginarium, he's playing Heath Ledger, right? And so at some point, you just sort of lose track of all of this. I mean, people would pop in and I'd think, oh, well, I must have seen him earlier in this movie and just missed it.
He's like the human equivalent of St. Paul's Cathedral.
It's true. At least he didn't play Daniel Day-Lewis.
Who has a rigorous method of preparation. He's famous for immersing himself in roles. Like when he played Christy Brown in My Left Foot, he went every day to a Dublin school for disabled kids. That is method acting.
I've heard that, yeah.
His latest role is Italian filmmaker Guido Contini in Nine. It's based on Federico Fellini's influential classic 8 1/2. Day-Lewis plays a filmmaker who is completely unable to finish his ninth movie. That's because he's mired in memories of women and his complex relationships with his wife, his mistress, and his mother.
A film is a dream. You kill it writing it down. You kill it with a camera. The film might come to life for a moment or two and your actors breathe life back into it, but then it dies again, buried in film cans. Mysteriously, sometimes, in the editing room, a miracle happens when you place one image next to another so that when finally an audience sits in the dark, if you're lucky, very lucky, and sometimes I've been lucky, the dream flickers back to life again.
NPR's Robert Siegel spoke to Daniel Day-Lewis and asked him if it was really true that he had immersed himself into this role by learning Italian.
Yes, I read that somewhere too, and I've been so...
Was it perhaps true?
The most extravagant rumors seem to develop out of almost every piece of work that I ever take on, and although some of them might have some basis in truth, they're very often unrecognizable to me, and I wish I could claim I'm so tempted to lie about it. I do speak a little Italian. I understand a fair bit of Italian, but I'm not a fluent Italian speaker, no.
You didn't feel it necessary to become a scholar of Dante in order to take the part.
I would have loved nothing more if I'd had 5 years to prepare for the film.
People write that you have lent credence to the idea that, if you're going to play a man with a hat, you go become a milliner for five years, and you study hats, and you do immerse yourself very deeply in a character. Or is that half reality, half myth?
It's my reality, and I tried to avoid talking about it, rather in the way that Guido attempts to avoid talking about films at the press conference. And largely, I think I avoid talking about it because I never yet found a way of describing that strange process that made any sense to me, so I couldn't expect it to make sense to anybody else. I suppose the thing I would tend to say about it more than anything else is I work that way because that's my pleasure. It's not because it's not a science, obviously. And principally, whatever work you do, and I think all my colleagues would say the same thing, no matter what way we approach the work, it's ostensibly just in the hope of freeing our imaginations. And so I absolutely don't expect anyone else to do it. Any preparation, no matter what you do to engage in this work that we do as performers, is there any preparation that's stranger than the thing itself, than the actual work? Of course, if you step aside of it and cast a cold eye on that work, it seems utterly absurd that we should spend our lifetimes imagining ourselves into the lives of others and into worlds that aren't ours. So, a good healthy dose of denial, I think, helps. And therefore, I don't really think that any form of preparation is bizarre, that being the case.
It covers a lot of ground.
Does that make any sense?
Yes. I take your point.
I think my job is such a great job. Actors have the best job in the world. They get to play. They get to play the way children played when they were little kids. I mean, there is a lot of preparation involved in it, obviously. He talks about that. But they get to go and pretend to be somebody else. They get to play pretend. It sounds fabulous.
You have the best job in the world. You get to watch them play and eat popcorn.
You get to talk to all these neat people, though. I don't ever do that. This is great.
That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Bob Mondello.
I'm Netta Ulibi. How do you say goodbye in Italian?
I have no idea. Arrivederci.
Arrivederci. Is that right?
Yes.